Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons Learned, where we uncover wisdom for career, business, and life to an international audience of rising leaders. In other words, you'll find valuable insights that you can't find in a textbook because it took us years to learn the stuff. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host for today. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Today, we're joined by Jason Wong. When I looked at the LinkedIn profile, Jason Wong is an accredited leadership coach, a technology artisan, strategy ninja, and the kindness practitioner. Jason was born into one of Sydney's most successful and influential Chinese families and has fond memories of running around Sydney's Chinatown after school. He was educated at one of Australia's top selective private schools for boys, and with his family's network of connections, the world was his oyster. But his life didn't play out the way he thought it would be. And influenced by a number of key people and events, he embarked on a journey involving lots of deep reflection and making plenty of personal adjustments. He has held multiple leadership roles throughout his career, but believes that the most important and most satisfying role was being a stay-at-home dad to his three daughters, which included upping his game as a partner to his amazing wife. He works to improve technology leadership in not-for-profit, for-purpose, and community-focused organizations. He now runs his own coaching and strategic consultancy practice, Tiger Technology Leadership, developing tech leaders of the future. He's a former president of his children's schools PNC Association and is now the board secretary of the New South Wales PNC Federation, working with influential education stakeholders to improve public schooling in New South Wales. He also facilitates local dad groups and events to support and engage dads in their parenting journeys. Mate, very few people leave such deep impressions in my life, and you're certainly one of them that I've come across, you know, of the thousands that I've come across in my business. You're one of those people that have always occurred to me as someone who just lives out the values, you know, and how you behave and how you treat others. You know, it's just an aura about you. So, you know, I was very excited that you finally accepted my invitation to be interviewed for 10 Lessons Learned. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Yeah, no, it's always good having a chat with you.
So before I jump into your lessons, you shared with me quite a bio about yourself and your personal journey. You know, you're talking about being born into one of the richest and the most influential Chinese families in Sydney's Chinatown. What was growing up like?
Growing up at the time seemed pretty good. I didn't really know anything else. It was the way I thought that most people grew up. Well, definitely most people that I knew. It probably took me a while to realize after, you know, long after I left school that I was in a little bit of a bubble. But no, definitely at the time, yeah, life was pretty good. I was pretty spoiled as a kid. Got my own way most of the time, got lots of cool gifts, lots of cool toys, went on great holidays, lived in nice houses, drove around in nice cars, ate at nice restaurants. Yeah, and definitely thought life was awesome.
Well, you know, it's kind of almost the stereotypical, the dictionary definition of the crazy rich Asians. But all right, well, that actually brings us very nicely to lesson number one. And it kind of is surprising that, you know, being born into such a great childhood, why would your number one lesson be that it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice?
I guess that made it as number one because it encapsulates the real pivot in my life from thinking and living this life where we had a pretty high standing in society. My father's family, as you mentioned earlier, went to a pretty decent school, to the point where I guess my attitude at the time was, not only was it a boys' private school, my family and myself and possibly some of my peers that I went to school with, we believed it was the best private school or the best school in Australia. So, and that definitely that feeling growing up, you know, was, yeah, we felt like we mattered, that we're important. I suppose it was exacerbated by my family, primarily my dad's side of family, you know, constantly reminding us as children, how awesome we were as a family. and as I'm sure we'll get into, that sort of started to change after I left school, gradually, probably over a period of, 10, 15 years, I guess. It's probably still happening, where I guess I started becoming a bit more humble about where I came from, meeting lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds, and understanding that their story was very different to mine, but just as amazing, just as inspiring, and just as important, quite frankly. So the line that I put there, it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice, is actually from a rave song. So if anyone used to go to old school raves, there was a song by Scooter. I think it's called Move That Ass or Move Your Ass. And there's a line in there where the DJ just yells out, "It's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice." And I can still hear the beat in my head. I think it probably came at the stage of my life. I was obviously I was partying quite a bit and I was going to lots of raves. And it came at a time in my life where I was really beginning to reflect on that simple sentence and how it related to how I was, what I was trying to be, what I needed to be.
Well, was there a clear turning point when you realized, you used the word humbled? Was there an actual event that happened in your life where you realized that it was more important or it was more important to be nice?
There were definitely, I don't think there was one or even a couple of turning points. It was a series of events or series of incidents that happened over probably that 10-year period. And I suppose that it's really about how my relationships were going. Definitely my intimate partner relationships, but even just relationships with friends and family members. And I found that, because I think I value relationships with other people. I really do want to be a great partner, brother, nephew, son, and so on. But I definitely seem to be pissing a lot of people off. And definitely at first it was, it was obviously all their fault. It wasn't my fault. I was doing a pretty good job, I thought. But I started to notice consistent themes and consistent patterns. And I don't think I could just dismiss other people's opinions anymore. I think it dawned on me eventually that, I think it's me. And that probably started a lot of self-reflection, a lot of speaking to other people, a lot of trying to unpack and replay situations and scenarios that have played out in real life and trying to work out what had just happened there. It also led to my, and this was completely unintentional, it led to me really listening deeply to what people had to say and really observing very closely what people did, what they didn't do, how they behaved in certain situations, how they reacted or not reacted. And ultimately, over a period of years, it dawned on me that I think the way that I had been brought up was not really conducive to, the close relationships that I wanted to have, the close genuine relationships that I wanted to have with people. And then so commenced the journey of trying to work out, what do I need to do to improve that? And a lot of it was just be a decent person. I'll tell you, I'm not exaggerating to say that I was pretty selfish. Everything was pretty much about me. It came from the upbringing, it came from the school. I'm not sure how much of that was in me already, when I was born. We're not really going to get into a nature nurture argument here, but I'd realized that I needed to be a better person, and that required accepting some hard truths about what I had been doing, and then trying to work out, how the hell do I change that? Because, changing any long seated behavior takes a long time. I think the common saying is, the first step is recognizing the undesirable behavior in the first place. And that's spot on. But it's bloody hard after that, even just, I recognized it, but I couldn't, took me a while to change it. And I would argue that I'm still, you know, I'm still working on it. I'm not perfect.
No, and that's definitely something I've noticed. What's quite interesting to me is, how did you come to the realization that meaningful relationships, as you mentioned, were more important than the wealth and the status in your life, you know, as you were brought up? Like, is that something that you just dawned on you one day that, you know, even though you had all the sort of trappings of, you know, success, you know, that importance, that status, that money, that power, all that, is there something that sort of dawned on you that you're just not happy without the relationships around you being fulfilling?
Oh, I suppose there were a couple of things that were happening concurrently. One was, I think from probably my mid-teens, I reckon, I was quite obsessed with the meaning of life and trying to understand, you know, what are we doing here? What is our purpose? What is everyone? What are we all doing? We all seem to be doing slightly different things, do we all have different purposes? Definitely at one stage, you know, got a little bit obsessed about death and dying and what happens. And, you know, as I'm assuming, you know, a lot of people would have. But then trying to, you know, I think from that came some thoughts about, okay, well, death's going to happen, can't do anything about that. But, you know, what do I want to do with my 70, 80, 90 years on this planet? And look, I don't remember explicitly thinking this at the time, but actually before I say that, I'll compare and contrast that with what I was seeing was happening. So definitely grew up in, not just my family and my education, but everything you were seeing on media and, you know, in society, was all pretty much about making as much bloody money as you can so that you could buy all this awesome stuff. You could buy the nice cars, the great holidays, the nice houses, you know, all those sort of things. But I was in an environment where I had all that, and I'd had more than pretty much anyone that I knew, other than maybe a handful of people. And definitely, as you know, through my teens, I realized, well, I started to think, well, yeah, I don't know whether this is really cutting it for me, you know, because it's all right, but it's not, there's, I suppose there was nothing deep inside me that was stirring, that was saying, yeah, this is bloody fantastic, you know, you should keep going along this path. I mean, I was also seeing the family that I was in was completely dysfunctional. You know, there was I don't even know whether there's any mutual respect. That's why when, you know, I know it's, you know, a bit of a funny throwaway line. Like when you watch Crazy Rich Asians, it is like a documentary on my family. And so, yeah, sometimes when, you know, when I do watch things like Crazy Rich Asians or any of the stand-up comedians, it's funny, but, you know, it's also a little bit cringeworthy because I'm like, oh, far out, that was my life. Yeah, and so when I was going back to that, so that's what I was seeing. I was seeing, well, okay, well, this is what society is striving for. This is society is striving to have the amount of wealth and influence. I haven't really spoken about the influence, but my family, pretty influential in Sydney's Chinatown. I might have mentioned this to you before, but my grandfather was regarded at one time as the unofficial Lord Mayor of Chinatown. He was integral to a lot of the stuff that happened in, especially Dixon Street in the 70s and 80s, you know, including the mall and so on. So there was this, yeah, there was definitely always this aura of, you know, being really, really important, but really influential. I think it's not a massive surprise that my family had a little bit of political clout as well. This had a lot to do with the fact that the Labor Party offices were just down the road from Chinatown, and they would come and eat quite regularly at these restaurants. So my family was pretty close with definitely members of the Labor Party. A lot on paper was going really well, but, you know, go and scratch the surface a little bit. And it was really weird. It was just like, far out, this is not the way people should treat each other. So, yeah, and I think, unfortunately, I was subconsciously, this was probably seeping into the way that I was treating people, you know, including, you know, former girlfriends. And I had to work out pretty quickly that, you know, this needs to change. Otherwise, I'm going to get old and lonely and miserable. And there was also something which I was really, really wanting to happen to me.
I'm sure we'll get into some of this in more detail in a lesson down the track. But you mentioned, you know, that there's a moment of realization. So that probably leads us well to lesson number two, be comfortable being uncomfortable. Now, what spurred you on to share this lesson?
I suppose one of the pivotal moments that I mentioned, it was actually something that my uncle on my mum's side said to me, and I'll mention that in a sec. But essentially, growing up, I was, a bit of a high achiever. I was pretty good at everything that I did. I did pretty well academically. I was pretty good on the sporting field. And I think the way that I was parented definitely added to that whole feeling of I am effing awesome. and what that meant was I didn't allow myself to make mistakes. I was definitely a perfectionist. I was, if you look at my report cards from school, they say that, clearly a pretty smart kid, but like doesn't say anything in class. And that was purely because I wouldn't put my hand up and say anything unless I was 100% sure that what I was about to say was correct. And this obviously continued into my mid to late teenage, young adult life, that I hated losing. I needed to win. Hated getting anything wrong. And I suppose it was pretty obvious, obviously, for people that knew me, that I needed to chill out a little bit. But it took an uncle, like I said, on my mum's side. I think I must have been in my early 20s. And I just had a big argument with one of his staff members, because he also ran restaurants. And he was trying to get me to apologize to that staff member. And I was like, nah, I'm not bloody apologizing, And then he explained to me how, I had been in the wrong, and I sort of accepted that. But then I thought, I'm still not apologizing. but he said to me something which was so simple at the time. He just said to me, Jason, it's okay to be wrong, And I think I responded with, yeah, of course, yeah. But it really stuck with me, and I thought about it. And I'm thinking, why would he say that to me? And then I thought about it and said, okay. Yeah, I bloody hate being wrong. And I hate being wrong because there was definitely a part of me that found it unacceptable. And I did need to give myself a bit of a break every now and then. And it's something which that little saying, has stuck with me. I say it to my kids all the time. It's part of the way that we parent our kids, to let them know that mistakes are fantastic learning opportunities.
But
it took me a while to realize that, it was not something which anyone had ever said explicitly to me before. It's not something which I worked out myself, obviously. So yeah, that's why that's in there.
I wonder how much of that is cultural, because, everything you said about hating being wrong and staying silent in class unless you're 100% sure. I mean, that's all me too, right? And for me, it might have taken even longer until I realized that, until you give yourself that permission to be wrong, then you give your permission to grow. And unfortunately, the earlier you learn that, the better it is. And in fact, kids that not obsess about being perfect tend to grow a hell of a lot quicker, because, they give themselves permission to learn and make mistakes and grow and step outside of comfort zone and push boundaries and learn new things.
And that's why, the lesson, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, is very much about, you're going to find yourself in uncomfortable positions, but that's okay. Don't shy away from there. You could absolutely stuff up and have egg all over your face, but you're going to learn a lot from that experience. And I would argue that if you're not putting yourself in uncomfortable positions, you're not pushing yourself hard enough. You're just cruising. We all need to do that. And I need to roll myself sometimes in that too. Just because I think something's just a little bit too hard at face value, it doesn't mean that I shouldn't have a crack.
Yeah, I 100% agree with what you said there, because if you're not feeling uncomfortable, then you're not achieving your potential. If anything, it's anything but, your potential. So yeah, 100% that you need to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Lesson number 3 I really like: don't aim for a bigger piece of the pie, aim to make the pie bigger. I mean, this kind of speaks to your philosophy in life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose it talks to another sort of pivotal change in my life, where I changed industry. So I had been working for a small IT team in an education organization, a university basically, and, looking like I was, going to climb the corporate ladder eventually and, make mega bucks. But then it was also around this time where I was trying to think about, what do I want my next job to be? And this job came up
in a not-for-profit organization, humanitarian aid organization, actually a pretty well-known one. And it was a step back in terms of pay, but it was a step up in terms of role and opportunity. So anyway, so I bit the bullet. I was definitely had outgrown my previous organization and role, bit the bullet, took that job. And what I realized working in that not-for-profit NGO space was that I was surrounded by people that had this philosophy, don't aim for a bigger piece of the pie, aim to make the pie bigger. So we would collaborate a lot with peers in like-minded organizations. From a business or corporate sense, you would see these other NGOs or not-for-profit organizations as competitors, because we're all competing for donors' money primarily from the fundraising perspective. But I'm not sure whether I read it or heard it or someone said it to me that, you know, the idea was, oh no, we're not really competing against them. We're not competing, you know, for a bigger piece of the pie. Our aim as this third sector is to make the pie bigger, is to encourage people, whether it's through our NGO or that NGO over there or that little charity over there, to encourage people to think about some of the issues that these organizations focus on and dedicate, you know, if not their money, their time to basically helping people that are less fortunate as ourselves. So it sort of started from there. But I mean, as you know, you've known me for a while now, whereas I pretty much only work for organizations that have a purpose, you know, or a charitable cause. And I really like working with people that are just trying to make things better for everyone. I think the organization I recently worked with was focused on kindness, focused on kind leadership. And I remember, you know, working with the CEO there and a few other senior people there, we were trying to define what kind leadership is. Because definitely in some ways it's a little bit, you know, wishy-washy. What we landed on is, I think what I've mentioned to you previously, in that kind leadership is essentially making things better for everyone, you know, recognizing the positive impact that you can have on all stakeholders and building a community of followers around you to do this thing collectively.
Lesson number four, I love this, and I can certainly see it every time I see you. I think it grows, and it never ceases to surprise me, and I think it's become a bit of your brand as well. Lesson number four, you said, grow the fro. So why should people grow the fro?
You know, people have definitely heard this before, but like, be yourself, be authentic. Again, harks back to the way that I was brought up, that one of the other things that was always a big part of my life was always being hyper aware of what other people thought about me. I think when you grow up in an environment where you believe that everyone is just looking up to you and everyone thinks that they want to be you. I think recently when I gave my Sydney Fringe talk, I was talking about my dad. And I was talking about a story of how, you know, we used to walk through Chinatown. I was a little kid and he was like this celebrity rock star walking through Chinatown. Women wanted him and men wanted to be like him. You know? And so I grew up in that environment where everyone, you know, wants to be like me and all that sort of stuff. And so when it didn't go that way, it was, yeah, problematic, you know, it was... And so you're constantly trying to work out how to please people, I suppose, or how do I get that person to like me? Why don't they like me? But it probably took me a gradual realization to just really embrace who I am and what I'm about. You know, I mean, I don't think deep inside the person that I am is still exactly the same when I started this journey. I've just done a lot of polishing around the edges and, you know, got a whole heap of crap that was there. And I suppose the best representation of that, is my hair. So one year I decided to like grow my hair out. I was just thinking, what happens if I just don't cut my hair?
It's not an act of rebellion against your parents or anything like that. It's just more, you know, your self-expression, is it? Or
so my hair was like this probably for about 10, 12 years. So most, whenever I go to a high school reunion, especially for those that haven't been one before and they see me, they go, oh, you know, why, what's going on? Yeah, you know, love it. So my hair is, you know, sort of thick and wiry. And I was wondering, knew what it would look like. Yeah, I've got this fro, basically. I think I was one of the definitely one of the few Asians walking around Sydney with a fro, but I do notice a few more of us out there. I was trying to keep trying to come up with a name for Asians with afros. The best one that I can come up with is Frosians. I feel my other Frosian brothers and sisters out there, and we give a head nod to each other, you know, when we see each other. Yeah, and sort of getting back to that authentic me, it taps into that not worrying anymore about what other people thought about me.
Mate, well, that moves us to lesson number 5, the most important gift you can give your loved ones is your time. Yeah, this reminds me of that talk you did at the Fringe Festival.
It's a reflection on how I was brought up, and how I was parented and how I'm parenting now. Like I've said, you know, I had everything. You know, I had all the trappings. I was getting not just more pocket money than most other kids. I was getting 10 times more pocket money than most other kids. At the time, it was fine. It was good. I didn't think anything of it. It's only when I've got a bit older and reflected back on my relationship with my parents, my dad in particular, and then obviously the relationship that I want to have with my kids. And all that stuff that I got, all that wealth and great gifts and great holidays and so on. Yeah, I definitely appreciate them, but all I wanted was a dad. I never did anything with my dad. My dad never came to anything that I did at school. I said I was pretty high achiever at school, so there were lots of things he could come to. Didn't come to a rugby game, didn't come to athletics carnival, didn't come to a play. Didn't teach me how to fish or throw a footy or anything like that. You could definitely argue that I've massively overcorrected, you know, because I pretty much go to everything of my kids' things now. You know, I've chosen a career where I've got extreme flexibility. So it's very rare for me to miss anything to do with my kids. You know, I'm really pleased with the relationship that I have with my kids. And I'm really pleased, you know, the balance we have in me being quite involved in their lives, but also definitely taking a step back and letting them just live their lives. And that's only from spending a lot of time with them and understanding how all three of them tick and what they need and what they don't need.
Well, what strikes me about that particular talk that you gave about what it means to be a man is exactly that, right? You know, the society tells you that a man should be a provider and should be sort of strong and, you know, be out there, and success is defined by what you can produce. I felt what you said about what it means to, and sort of redefining what it means to be a man, that was really revolutionary in terms of the idea, right? And you certainly lived it.
Thanks, mate. You know, and that's definitely, I mean, a lot of the stuff which I spoke about in that talk was stuff that I tried, that I realized worked, and which I continued doing. And so just picking up what you said a second about being provider, as men were expected to be the provider, but the provider has always been in the context of providing the money and the shelter and the housing and the trappings of a good life. Let's pivot that little bit and let's still be providers, but let's be the providers of love and insight and knowledge and fun and laughter and support, emotional support. I think there's definitely still a role for men as providers, but we just need to pivot our definition of what providing means. So it's not just about bringing the cash in. This lesson for me is, again, sounds a bit cliche, but the most valuable thing you can give your loved ones is your time. Time is the only finite resource that we all have. And look, I've definitely spoken to a few older dads, kids either grown up and left the house or not far off it. And they've said to me, we've had these conversations, they said to me, mate, I wish I'd realized what you realized earlier, because I feel like I've missed out a lot on my kids' upbringing. You know, they got okay relationships with their kids, some better than others, some a little bit dysfunctional, but some of them sort of, I probably spent too much time focusing on my career and making, you know, mega bucks and not actually being there for my family.
Well, you can't get it back, right? Like you said, it's a finite resource, time. You can't get it back when it's gone. And I suppose that's why we're having this conversation. You know, we hope to share wisdom like this. And again, might sound a bit unconventional, but yet these are the sort of things that I find probably most valuable to our listeners. So that I think is very, very insightful. So lesson number 6, strive to win, but strive harder to lose gracefully. Now, I'm assuming you're talking about sports.
Sort of. It's definitely inspired by sport. Look, I'm reminded of it every weekend when I watch my kids play sport. There is way too much focus on winning for the sake of winning and not enough focus on just trying to do the best that you can. Look, again, it does come from comments like my childhood. I told you, I won most things. I won everything. I hated losing. When I lost, I was pretty unpleasant to be around because of, you know, well, the standards that I set myself and because it was not something that happened very often. But I remember, you know, the whole lose gracefully comment there is not, I'm pretty sure that when I was younger, not only did I really take pleasure in winning, I think I took pleasure in other people losing as well. You know, I'll talk specifically about my 10-year-old who's, you know, pretty decent on the athletics field. And what I say to her regularly, you know, after a race or before a race, or I say, look, yeah, try to win, but it's okay if you don't win. And if, you know, be happy for the person or the people that beat you. Have a bit of respect for them, see if you can learn from them. But ultimately, you know, just try and do your best and try to do your best for that day. It's not necessarily, you know, get a PB every time you run out there. And afterward, we can have a bit of a chat. And even if you come last, that's fine. We can have a chat afterwards and find out, well, why'd you come last? What's happening? You're tired? Is something on your mind? You got a sore foot? I guess because, you know, that focus on winning that I had so much for so much of my life was ending up in so much disaster from my emotional resilience perspective and just relationships that I've had. It was in some ways it's related to that, you know, it's okay to be wrong, you know, thing. It's like, it's okay to lose. Hmm. It's okay not to win. And what I had to learn was how to lose gracefully. I had to overcome that sore loser thing. Well, now if I lose, I'll usually come up with 5 reasons, all of which are my fault. and then I usually reconcile that and work out, well, you know, well, why did that happen? Or did I actually, you know, oh, maybe I did my best. Oh, okay. Coming third was actually bloody, I couldn't have done any better than that. I should be pretty happy with that rather than being devastated that I didn't win.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I've certainly been a parent at these sporting events on the sidelines, and often I find myself getting lost in that competitiveness and all that. And I realize that we're probably teaching the kids the wrong things when we focus way too much on winning. But, you know, in terms of losing gracefully, and I like that word graceful in understanding what that means. And sometimes, yeah, the other kids were just simply better. The other kids were more talented. Yeah, probably worked harder and they trained better and they had a better, they executed better on the day and they were ready for it, you know, and sometimes it's important to teach your kids to be inspired by their competitors. You know, this is how good you could be, you know, watch these guys, you know, this is what you'd be aiming for. What they did really well, that's what you should strive to become. You know, I like the fact that you focus on effort. So it's all about controlling what's within your control. So yeah, great lesson. Thanks for sharing that. Lesson number 7, and I'm sure I've heard this one before, but you said that you never know enough. It sounds like that's another way of saying never stop learning.
Yeah. So look, I know. I mean, it had to be in there because, you know, I was a bit of a know-it-all, I suppose. I was definitely the sort of person that believed that what I didn't know wasn't worth knowing. You know, I sort of had that sort of attitude. But I suppose one way of demonstrating how embedded this is in our lives now. So after school, not every day, but most days, I'll ask my kids 4 questions. What did you learn today?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do that was fun? What did you do that was hard? And what did you do that was kind? So in relation to this point, so I want them to try and experience those 4 things every day. Want them to constantly look for, you know, you're at school obviously to learn, but what you're learning at school may not necessarily be stuff that a teacher's told you or you read from a digital textbook. You know, you might have learned something else about yourself, for example. So I've sort of encouraged this in our kids, and my wife and I have to answer these questions as well. So we're not going, obviously, going to school. And so we've also got to say, what did we learn today? And sometimes it might have been, you know, a white paper that I was reading that I could regurgitate. But other times it's, you know, learning a little bit more about someone that I knew that I didn't know before, or learning something about some situation. I probably don't need to talk much about this because, you know, lots of people keep saying, you know, you've got to learn. But It's something which is important enough to remind my kids every day that every day we get to learn something new and interesting. Don't forget that.
That's actually quite interesting because that wasn't where I thought the lesson was about, you know, and like you said, sort of, you know, never stop learning is important, but it sounds like this was more around having the right attitude towards life in terms of humility, in terms of not knowing, realizing you don't know everything, and so that you can approach life with the same kind of curiosity and the ability to grow from that. So that's definitely not exactly what I thought it was about. So yeah, I learned something new, and I will be using those four questions for my kids as well. So thanks for sharing that. Lesson number 8, everyone has something to offer.
Yeah, so look, this is primarily about me learning how to respect diverse opinions, listen to people that I wouldn't ordinarily think that would be worth listening to. Again, comes from that little bubble that I grew up in and believe that, you know, only certain people worth listening to. Look, my dad's words still ring in my ear of how he would basically assess people based on their utility. And he would, you know, I definitely got the message growing up that some people were worth listening to and some were not. Whereas I've moved towards believing that everyone is worth listening to. Everyone has got something to offer. You know, I suppose ultimately it's what diversity and inclusion is all about. And it's something which, you know, I didn't think too much about until I sort of started working it a little bit more and started to understand why diversity is important. All these things related, it goes back to that whole be comfortable with being uncomfortable. Yes, go into a room with someone who doesn't speak English very well and it's got a completely different worldview from you. You're going to feel bloody uncomfortable. I can guarantee you walk out of there learning a lot, you know, if, you know, about the situation you're talking about, but about yourself, about them. And yeah, and obviously try to set up mechanisms where you're explicit about including these people in conversations.
This is actually a very interesting perspective on diversity and inclusion, right? So typically when we talk about diversity and inclusion, it's always about gender or race or sexual orientation. But what's really interesting about your story is that you have you're part of an in-group of a dominant culture, and that is an affluent, influential family and a very strong set of values that you live in this world where you've got a set of rules that you follow very strongly, and you're able to sort of see the bubble or recognize the bubble you live in and acknowledge the diversity outside of that bubble. I find that very, very fascinating because typically you think of yourself as the outsider if you're not part of the dominant culture, and yet you're able to see that and see the value in all these other people. So I guess it probably stems from the fact that it's that awareness that being part of that family has brought you, you know, that you've excluded those people that you feel didn't have any value. And yet later on, appreciating that it did bring something to the table, it's just that you have to be open to it. But yeah, that's very insightful. Thank you. Lesson number 9. I agree, but this is very difficult to do. Lesson number 9, you say, don't stay silent, call out unfairness and injustice and take action. Well, that's easy if you're someone in an affluent family and have a whole lot of power. How does an average person do that?
No, it's interesting that you say that because definitely a lot of the affluent people that I used to hang out with and still hang out with now, but I remember even when I was a teenage kid, a lot of the extremely wealthy and families that I used to hang around weren't really aware of the unfairness and the injustices that were happening around the world, let alone doing anything about them because there was no unfairness or injustice in their lives. I remember sitting at home at a friend's place and we're watching some news item on the Iraq war. And there was a story on people flying over, I think from Australia, who were horrified by that the war was happening. But they were flying over there to be human shields. And I remember my friend's mum, she just made this comment. She was watching this article on the news and she said, oh, what are those people doing as if they're going to make a difference? And I don't know why that stuck with me. There was something on that day where I just thought, far out, like you could make a difference. you've got access to resources, you know, and people and money that could probably make a bloody difference. You know, these people that are flying over there are like on, you know, minimum wage. Yeah, I understand little things like that. I think it was also when I started working for those, you know, NGOs and not-for-profits. One of them was filled with activists, and I could see how little steps, little bits of effort from lots of people could make a difference. I definitely had the mentality that if I don't think I'm actually going to have any significant impact here, I don't think I'm going to bother. But, you know, I've sort of learned that I suppose you spend most of your life meeting lots of different people, just planting seeds everywhere. You know, who knows what impact the conversation that you had with someone on the train will have, you know. And if you can start a small movement and get a small gathering on a cause that you believe in, well, we should do it. If you believe in something passionately enough, do something, even if it's small. There are so many stories out there of people that have started with just some small gesture towards something they believe passionately in. And then, you know, lo and behold, they've set up something which is quite impactful now. I suppose the final point I'd make about that is that being a man talk, I mentioned that one of the predominant characteristics of traditional male archetype is to be assertive. And I'd mentioned at the beginning of that talk that assertive usually meant, you know, loud and dominant and aggressive and being the boss. And like I did with all those other attributes of the male, traditional male archetype, I flipped that and said, yeah, let's still be assertive, but let's be assertive by calling out injustices. Let's be assertive by, you know, calling out unfairness, calling out your mates when they're being, you know, probably a bit too sexist than they should be. And I mean, I have conversations with my teenage daughter now about the way that people talk to each other, all the sexism and the horrifying things that are happening. But I've sort of said to her, like, you know, I said those things. I acted like that. I'm horrified by it now. But, you know, I've learned, and I think perhaps it was for me as well, there would have been a few friends and family members that actually cared for me. They gave me a bit of a tap on the shoulder and said, yeah, you probably shouldn't be saying that or doing that.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to your point about being authentic as well. What the saying is that the standards that you walk past is the standards you condone. And if you don't do anything about it, even though it's something small, even a small thing could potentially end up being a big difference. So yeah, I'd certainly take that point, and I agree with that, that we should, even if it's something very small, that we shouldn't be a bystander.
Yeah.
Agree with that. So lesson number 10, but before I jump into lesson number 10, I'm going to throw you a curveball. If you listen to any of our podcasts before, you know that we'll ask you, what have you unlearned? You know, and by that, what I meant is that something that you held to be gospel truth when you're starting out, you know, maybe in your 20s, and then later on you found out that just wasn't the case.
Well, you can argue that almost everything that I've said today was, you know, it was all about me unlearning stuff.
That's true, isn't it? Yes.
You know, and I think it's even from one of the first comments I made to you, you know, from private school boy and crazy rich Asian to just trying to be a top bloke, you know, that's essentially my life story. So what? But it does sort of tie into the last point. So spoiler alert, that probably the biggest thing that I had to unlearn was that it's just not about me.
All right, well, that's a perfect segue. Lesson number 10, put yourself last and first. So what you're saying is not about you. So what do you mean by put yourself last and first?
So my last point is, you know, a bit of a riddle. Put yourself last and first. So the put yourself last bit is very much about recognizing that it's not all about you. And recognizing that to try and have a more giving nature, you know, not just look for opportunities where you might benefit. First thing that has popped up in my mind was a few years back, I was a volunteer youth mentor for a, you know, youth organization. And they asked me to speak at one of their presentation days. And I don't really remember anything that I said in their speech other than what I'm about to tell you now. I think one of the questions they wanted me to answer was like, why do you do this? Why do you volunteer your time to be a youth mentor?
And yeah, there are lots of reasons why, you know, I'm helping people, it makes me feel good. But ultimately what it came down to was I'm doing this because I can. And that was it. I was trying to remove the motivation for that act from any self-serving purpose. And I was also trying to remove the motivation from, you know, I suppose what's in it for me, moving away from that what's in it for me attitude to what's in it for everyone else, what's in it for all the other people who are going to be impacted. And I sort of, you know, learned to let other people get recognition for stuff that they've done. Look, I think another one of my little mantras for any teams that I've led, and, you know, and I'll mention this sometimes to people that I'm coaching, is that a good leader will not completely deflect credit, but take credit collectively as a team rather than, you know, hogging all the credit for him or herself or themselves. But they will also, you know, take responsibility for something that goes wrong, even if it's pretty clear that it was one particular person that completely stuffed something up. I suppose it's basically a call for just being really empathetic. You know, just making, you're constantly thinking about how this is impacting other people as well. Don't just think about how this is making you feel and, you know, whether it's like something could make you feel elated and completely filled with joy. But if you take another 5 seconds to think about the impact for the 10 other people that are going to absolutely be devastated, you might want to, you know, dampen your joy a bit if it means that other people aren't going to be devastated. So it's about empathy. It's about being a bit more humble. So that's the put yourself last, okay? Mm. Put yourself last and first. So don't forget about you. I mean, there's so much in anything you want to read about, you know, the business world, leadership, parenting, effective relationships, where you've got to take time out for yourself. You've got to take self-care. I think ultimately it's really hard for you to be effective in anything if you haven't sorted your own shit out first, whatever it is, whether it's a job, whether it's a volunteer role, whether it's your marriage, whether it's parenting. You know, it's really, really hard to be effective, not just because your mind is not optimized. Definitely your mind's not thinking straight. You're not making logical decisions as well if you've got a whole lot of other stuff that's going on and you're not dedicating as much time to focus on it. But it's also, I think you mentioned earlier, it's like the role modeling that you do.
Hmm.
You know, it's really hard to role model, whether it's the employees that work for you, your peer managers, your kids. If you're saying something and they're demonstrating the complete opposite behavior. So that's what I meant by put yourself first. So one of the, going back to that kind leadership organization that I was working for, one of the things that we did was we defined leadership, kind leadership, in these pillars of kindness. Mm-hmm. So mentioned earlier that kind leadership was about making everything better for everyone, but we sort of tried to define everyone. So it was like, you know, kindness to people. So like kindness to your people was like part of it. Kindness to community. So that's like a different sort of group of people, you know, and the external stakeholders. There was kindness to the environment as well, mm-hmm. kindness to customers. And the one that we, that was it initially. And it took us a while to work out that, we left out the most important pillar. Kindness to self. Mm-hmm. And that's something which, you know, definitely when I was working for that organization, but even it, you know, it pervades through a lot of stuff that I'm doing now, my leadership coaching, you know, about thinking about you. You know, I have this little thing called leadership in multiple directions where I talk about, you know, how do you lead? Because when we think about leadership, we often talk about leading down. How sort of a boss am I? Sort of, and that's absolutely, you know, massive part of leadership. But I also talk about leadership up. I talk about leadership across. I talk about leadership out. And I also talk about leadership in. And leadership in is very much that self-work piece. Liking yourself, you know, and understanding why you like yourself. And if you don't like yourself, try and, you know, spend some time with yourself to understand why. Or, you know, ask people that you trust. I mean, there's a whole lot of work that can be done on yourself that will, you know, improve everything.
No, and that's what I thought first. But now that you explained it that way, it makes perfect sense. Ultimately, you've got to be in a position to, I mean, you want to do good for others. But ultimately, you know, if you're altruistic at a detriment to yourself, it's just not going to be sustainable. So it's understanding that balance in focusing on yourself and getting yourself ready. That's a really important life lesson. And I think it goes on to your point about that sustainable leadership. If you want to be kind, a lot of it starts with being kind to yourself. So thank you so much for sharing your lessons, Jason. That was a lot of fun. I've certainly enjoyed it and learned a bit myself. As always, you never cease to surprise me in terms of, you know, the kind of insights you provide in life. You know, clearly you're a very deep thinker and you know a lot of things happened in your life that makes you the person that you are. Thank you for your time today.
No, thanks. Thanks, Jeffrey. Yeah, no, that was good. It's always good to, you know, further reflect on your on reflections, you know, so that sounds very Inception or very meta.
All right, and we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to 10 Lessons Learned, the podcast that makes the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. We're joined today by our special guest, Jason Wong. This episode is produced by Robert Hostry and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that make the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thanks for tuning in and stay safe, everyone.